We've got Blair Levin back. For those of you who missed yesterday morning, Blair gave, I think, a stirring introduction to Commissioner Copps, who gave us an inspiring speech on net neutrality and coming together to come up with a national framework for internet policy. Blair, I think everyone knows you here, so why don't you just come up and...
Thank you very much. I'm going to introduce Reid Hundt. I'm assuming everyone knows Reid's background as chairman of the FCC, as an antitrust lawyer, and currently working for McKinsey, as well as on the boards of such companies as Intel and Tropos, as well as a number of other technology companies. What you probably don't know is he recently injured his arm so that his right arm is actually in a cast, even though you can't see it. I thought I'd just very, very quickly give an intro to perhaps put his background or a little bit of his background from his time as the FCC in the context of the network neutrality debate. Because the last couple of days of discussion about network neutrality have sometimes reminded me of the line from The Little Prince, that which is essential is invisible to the eye. And from what I've seen from the discussion, one thing that's missing is how the importance of how networks interconnect and who pays what for the ability to connect to the dominant networks. And the importance of this can be seen in looking at the key policy decisions, invisible to nearly all at the time, that at least at one time led to our being a world leader in the internet and led to an explosion of wireless alternatives and innovation. I could talk about a number of them. I'm just going to note two. In 1994, with the advent of Netscape and the mass market internet, the phone companies brought their rather considerable political prowess to bear on the FCC in an effort to change to charge per minute access fees for use of their last mile copper loops to connect to the internet. The FCC resisted that pressure, and all the goods and the all you can surf model, which reflects both economic reality and good economic growth policy, was born, initially leading the US to be in the primary position of internet usage. In 1996, wireline phone companies were able to charge wireless phone companies huge per minute terminating access charges. Again, despite considerable opposition from the phone companies, the FCC forced those prices down to reflect economic reality. That act, in combination with the spectrum auctions concluded the prior year, led to an explosion of wireless innovation, price drops, and put wireless in a position to be a competitor for voice and data services. Without that policy, they couldn't have been. What those two decisions had in common was an FCC with the economic rigor, the policy vision, and the political moxie to do the right thing for the country. And what they also had in common was the tough-minded and courageous leadership of our next speaker, Reid Hundt. Looking back, he reminds me of the lines from a poem, "There was a time before our time, it will not come again, when the best ships still were wooden ships, but the men were iron men." And other than his right arm, I'd like to bring up our next speaker, the Iron Man, Reid Hundt. Please join me in welcoming him.
So literally, Blair is my right-hand man once again, and I'm a pure left-winger now. People ask me how I managed to break this bone. 3% of all fractures are the humerus bone. My orthopedic surgeon said the humerus is not funny. He's a real cut-up. But how did I break it? I was on a hunting trip with the vice president, and I ducked. He just winged me. Thank you all very, very much for inviting me. I see a lot of friends here. And I like the way you've elevated classroom muttering to the high art of bathroom wall scrawling. I certainly think in postmodernist terms, you've objectified me and I'm the subject of your incoherent discourse. But I have the following post-structuralist thing to say to you, which is I have some amusing remarks, which I hope are captured authentically on the screen here. And my amusing remarks today come from the Wall Street Journal. March 28, 2006. How France Became a Leader in Offering Faster Broadband by Leila Aboud. I'll just read you the first paragraph. For years, France's telecommunications industry was a state-owned monopoly with one of the world's most backward broadband markets. But thanks to deregulation 6 years ago, French consumers have access to a high-speed internet service that is much faster and cheaper than in the U.S. So, Leela, at the end of the article, gave her email address, and I can only type until this thing gets better with my left hand, suitable for communications to France, and I typed out the following to Leela. I praise your article, but I note that in French, apparently, quote, deregulation, unquote, equals, quote, enforceable unbundling regulations. Leela wrote back. I'm not making this up. You're right. The word deregulation was a bad choice in that sentence. Saying, quote, opening up the phone lines to competition, unquote, would have been preferable. In other words, deregulation should have been understood to mean regulation. With this little key adjustment, I think you can successfully read the Wall Street Journal with impunity from here on out. You can also understand government policy as it's said in the United States and certainly as it's described in the House of Representatives. You can also understand exactly why a part of the fix that we're in my judgment, as a country here in the United States, is that we don't have an intelligible discussion in real, honest, candid terms about matters of importance. We don't have a concept of objectivity, even a concept of truth, that ought to be the basis of any discussion about net neutrality or openness or even freedom itself. So, in the dark, as I have now been left, I will struggle with my notes. And let me begin by giving you the following context for the open network or non-neutral network discussion that we're having in America. This is an old story. It is the story of distribution and transportation systems since the beginning of time. It is the battle between distributors and content, whether we're speaking about the Terminal Railways case, whether we're speaking about the fight in the late 19th century for an interstate commerce commission that would have some impact on carriers who were pitted against the monopoly power of railroad carriage. It is the same as the discussion between theater owners and theatrical exhibition that led to the Paramount case in 1948. It is an old story. The purpose of competition is to create a bottleneck and to hold it, and from that bottleneck to extract rents. This is not something that is morally pernicious. It is part of the nature of competition. It is, however, the case that, as John Kenneth Galbraith said 50 years ago, the United States has always been a country of private wealth and public poverty. And what we've seen in the last 20 years is the emergence of new and different ways to try to obtain private wealth instead of and from the topics in which there used to be some public property. So we've seen this transition between public property and public good to private wealth and private maximization again and again and again. We see it in Iraq today, where to an astonishing degree, one that has never, ever been part of the United States' history, we have a war that is financed and operated significantly by private sources. We have an untold number of private contractors who were involved in security, involved in combat-like operations in Iraq. We have in healthcare in the United States a move to convert virtually everything that might have been and is in other countries part of a public system to a private system. The idea that the president is currently avowing is that people should buy more insurance so as to be able to fund more private access to health care, not to replicate the Veterans Administration and its delivery of public benefits. We see in education more and more money being paid. It costs more to get a so-called public education in the United States at the college level than in any other developed country in the world. at the University of California at Santa Barbara costs more than $20,000 a year for a California student to attend, a public university. The growth of charter schools, the development of more and more private schools are all part of this transformation. We saw 20 years ago in broadcast TV the move from a free over-the-air medium to a multi-channel pay medium. Now we're seeing in the 700 megahertz to 800 megahertz spectrum, historically designated for community broadcast for nonprofit networks, the spectrum, according to Congress, is going to be auctioned, and what used to be a free over-the-air broadcast medium, one-to-many, is going to be a private paid broadcast medium, one-to-many. Qualcomm, Crown Castle, those are the business models. So we're seeing this transformation across the board. It should come as no surprise whatsoever that the battle in the telephone industry is a battle in which the proprietors assert they have a property interest in the network. They wish to create a private internet. That's an oxymoron. They wish to create a private virtual network. They wish to sell access to that network and to bundle on that network content and conduit. There's nothing wrong with this. There's nothing surprising about it. What's important is that it be recognized that it is not the only way to organize an economy or society, and that we are not even close to talking about it in a way that reflects the importance and the gravity of the debate. How are we talking about it? Well, we're debating whether or not it would be the case that if a telephone company or a cable company or any access network owner had an extra dollar of profits, would it be more or less likely to put that extra dollar into building a more robust access network? That's the nature of the debate. Of course, it isn't really a debate in Congress today or at the FCC. It is the assumption of all policies that the answer is, of course, they would put more into the network if they had the extra dollar of profit. This is the same philosophical approach that the current administration has taken to the economy across the board. At the height of the boom of the 1990s, corporate profits in the United States were about $800 billion. They're now about $1.4 trillion. It's the fastest increase in the total amount of corporate profits in the history of the United States, probably in the history of any country committed to capitalism. This has not been an accident. It is the function of a combination of tax policy changes and a combination of industry structure changes in industry after industry after industry. It is a function of taking a hard look at the increases in commodities prices and deciding that the profits that will be captured for them will go to the producers, not to the consumers. Any economist will tell you that there's a certain amount of welfare gains, and in terms of Pareto optimality, it's essentially arbitrary whether or not the profits are given to the supplier or to the consumer. Well, it's arbitrary, but it matters a great deal for the standard of living of the consumers. If the consumers are able to get some of that, it matters a great deal to workers if they are able to share in those profits to some degree. In fact, this is a profitless recovery in terms of wage compensation. In fact, it is a high productivity recovery because all of the gains of the 1990s in the communications revolution have produced high productivity gains for businesses as they've ramped up production, but they haven't had to hire new workers. In fact, this tremendous pool of cash, this $1.4 trillion in profits, largely has gone uninvested in the United States. It is being distributed in dividends. It is being invested in other countries. And American corporations in general have the greatest amount of cash reserves that they've had in more than a generation. None of these things are an accident, and they are not morally unsound. They are not to be condemned from some leftist standpoint as obviously wrong. They're only to be judged for their effects. They're only to be looked at in terms of, do they align with your goals? And the question begged by network neutrality is this: what are the society's goals? What are the society's goals? Michael Porter of the Harvard Business School says the only right national economic policy is to produce a high and rising standard of living for the citizens of the country. High and rising. That suggests pretty clearly that there have to be productivity gains, but it also suggests that the benefits of those productivity gains must be translated into the standard of living, into the consumption and usage patterns of the people. That standard of living might not just be what you purchase, it might also include the access that you have as a citizen to public property. The great new creation of public property in the 30 years of the privatization of public benefits, the great new creation, of course, is the web. It's the greatest new creation of public property that's occurred in these 30 years, maybe the greatest creation of public property that has ever been, that has ever occurred in a modern society. Susan Crawford, a brilliant law professor at Cardozo, has written a piece I commend to you. She says that the core of the problem with the network neutrality debate is that the real advocates, those who ought to be the real advocates of network neutrality, don't have any lawyers. They don't have any names. They are the nameless and uncounted millions of us who enjoy expanded freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom to obtain knowledge, freedom of action, and freedom of creativity from participation in the public property of the web. Her point is, access network builders, God bless them, they're necessary, are not the proprietors of the web, nor are they the creators of the web. They are not the generators of this public property. They are the creators of the pathways to the public property. So the debate that we ought to have is this. From the perspective of the right national goal, do we want low-cost, very robust, high-speed access to this great public property, or do we want a very expensive, limited toll booth? That's the nature of the debate. If the debate is from the perspective of network builders, it is, she says, a debate about private property. I have private property. The Constitution says I should use it any way I want as long as I'm not doing any harm to others. And if that means that working in a unexpressed and tacit cooperation with some other duopolist, perhaps, I ought to be able to charge high fees for the means of transportation to get to the public park of the internet. And maybe when I create my private network, I ought to be able to make it less appealing to participate in that public commons, in that public park, and much more appealing to participate in the private environment that I will create. Less appealing means less participation. It means, in very practical terms, less usage, less bits per second, a less robust version of the public property, and at the expense of that, a more robust version of the private property. That's the fundamental debate. It's happened in education. It's happening in healthcare. It's happening in the pharmaceutical industry. It's happening with respect to intellectual property. It's the exact same debate with respect to the networks. There's not one thing about it that isn't predictable. The only thing, in my judgment, that is a little bit surprising is the astonishing abandonment of the field of discourse by the institutions that you would have thought would have at least felt empowered to talk about these things. Well, how can the poor FCC really, in all sincerity, be empowered when a subcommittee of Congress passes a bill that says, the one thing we want to make very clear about network neutrality is this: you shall pass no rules. The rulemaking process at the FCC under the APA, not one thing surprising about this, is meant to be an inquiry into the unknown where everyone comments, facts are developed, rules are formed in an open process. That's the purpose of the APA. And those rules are meant to provide a blueprint and a guide, signposts, and a paradigm that should govern industry structure, conduct, and performance. That's the purpose of these rules. all the rules that my friend Blair and I and our other colleagues wrote about telecom in the 1990s were shorter in the aggregate than the rules of Little League Baseball. They were criticized in a little larger volume than the total criticism directed at umpires in the entire history of baseball, but the rules themselves did emerge from that process. And although you won't read this in the Wall Street Journal, remember the key to reading the Wall Street Journal, yes is no, black is white, up is down. You won't read this. By and large, virtually every one of those rules was sustained in the United States Supreme Court. That's why you were always told when you do read the public press that they weren't sustained. What happened is they were sustained, but they weren't advocated any longer, starting post 9/11 when the paradigm change occurred. Now, these rules in this open process were meant to do the following: to empower users, to have it be that it would be, the internet would be a user-centric network in which startups would be subsidized, if you'll forgive the term, by such techniques as reciprocal compensation. Money would be paid to internet service providers by existing providers. And the rules also were meant to place the internet under the jurisdiction of common carriers. To those libertarians of the 1990s who may still be lurking somewhere, God bless you for your naive judgments that no rules were written about the internet in the 1990s. I forgive you for not knowing what you did not know, but I don't forgive you if you still harbor the assumption that those paradigms didn't exist and they weren't important, because it was only the creation of those paradigms that made the web accessible by everyone and made it be a platform not just for freedom of speech and association, but a petri dish for the creation of whole new companies, companies like Yahoo, AOL, Amazon, eBay, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of others. For those who think that the dot-coms were not productive and did not produce economic growth, I will tell you that Harvard Business School has studied this, and slightly more than 10% internal rate of return was, in fact, the growth rate of all the dot-coms added together for all of the 90s. That's not too bad. That's a lot better, by the way, than any service provider record in that time period. The open net created by regulation and by adjudicatory decisions, in fact, was a revolution in society, and it was a huge contributor to economic growth and to rising income equality and to rising wages. We now have everything that was going up going in the opposite direction. Is it totally a function of a closed net? No, it is not. Would a closed net be, if it were the new paradigm, the remedy, the thing that would jumpstart participation in democracy and a new wave of entrepreneurship and productivity gains that would be translated to more income increases on an annual basis for everyone in society? I don't know. I think the answer is yes. I will say this because I've said it in a book. Did I mention that I wanted you to buy this book? It's called In China's Shadow, The Crisis of American Entrepreneurship. It'll be out in August. I would appreciate it if everyone here would buy 100 copies. Actually, 1,000 would be good, because it's kind of a poor man's version of Tom Friedman's book. And he sold 350,000 copies so far in selling, and I'm jealous, so help me out. One of the things in this book is the following observation. Whatever China becomes in terms of an information society over the next 20 years has enormous impact on the United States in ways that we have not begun to imagine. But one of the ways is this. It is China's version of the internet that will be as or more powerful than the American and Western version of it within a generation. How would we like it if China had a non-neutral network? How would we enjoy it if China Telecom, for example, as the dominant provider of internet access, were to decide that a highly discriminatory approach was the correct paradigm? And oh, by the way, American flag firms were not to get equal and rapid and robust access to the internet, not in China or possibly in other places that might be influenced by their paradigm. In all times past, there would have been an absolute congruence between our fight for free trade and open markets on a global level and our battle for open networks in China. We could have counted on that. In the event that we in the United States decide to adopt over the next several years, in pursuit of the extra dollar of, we hope, investment in our capital structure, if we decide to adopt a closed network model in the United States, we have no basis on which to stand when we assert that we would prefer open networks in other countries and open access by our sellers over these highways to the consumers and users in these other countries. It is not an accident that the 1996 Telecom Act led to the World Trade Organization Telecom Treaty of 1997 that has in it the exact same principles, including unbundling and open networks. It's not an accident because in 1994, the Vice President of the United States in Buenos Aires said that it would be that way, that they would pass the Competition Act and then there would be a World Trade Organization Treaty. And it is not an accident that the principles of the 1997 WTO treaty have been followed in Japan and Korea, now in France and in other countries, to produce an open network paradigm where it is becoming routine that everyone will have access to 100 megabits per second, and that's so much throughput that it is trivial to talk about whether some fraction of those bits might be aligned with some particular content to create a VPN within the larger public thoroughfare. But in the United States, where we have the thin trickle of bits up and down and the limited access to the internet, for us, it is a clear and present issue of immense importance whether that access will be privatized and we will be dominantly a VPN-based system as opposed to an open access system. We are not now discussing in the United States any of the core facts. But most important, we are not talking about the impacts on free speech and free association of these particular issues. We have through a battle that I know that you've heard about, led by Michael Copps, we have our four principles. I greatly admire what Mike did to fight for these four principles at the FCC, but they are a palsied, weak, pale shadow compared to rules. They are not in substance addressing the issues. They do not provide guides. They do not provide signs. They do not lay out a program. And they are issued in the context of the House subcommittee saying that the FCC shall never have any rules at all. It will only decide things on a case-by-case basis. Case-by-case means this. It means all decisions are about something that occurred 5 or 6 or 7 years ago. They always mean that with the expenditure of lots of money on lawyers and appeals, any particular company can avoid an adjudication till long after the issue is relevant from a business perspective. Case-by-case adjudication does not affect capital expenditure planning, does not affect strategy, does not affect the way that networks are built. It is simply a rear view mirror look at what did happen, as opposed to a through the windshield look at what should happen. To say to the FCC, you can't have inquiry and you can't have rules, is the same thing as saying that the United States will have no plan. Well, we already decided in the last few years that we would have no broadband subsidy plan. We're the only country in the world that doesn't think broadband ought to be everywhere and for everyone, and where cost is an issue, we ought to find a way to subsidize. The only country in the world that takes that view. Does this mean that we are somehow or other more efficient in terms of profits? Absolutely. I already said that. In terms of reaching everyone and wrapping the whole country in a web of intelligence and creating one social fabric that can, in fact, be, among other things, a very low-cost distribution mechanism for dot-coms. In that respect, we are completely and totally to be deemed a failure. We are not committed, in my judgment, to creating a high and rising standard of living with the single most important tool for doing so, which is the web. And this is the discussion that we're not even having. These principles, access. Everyone should have access. The upstream access isn't discussed. It isn't even part of the discussion. It's incredibly important. There's no discussion of price, no discussion of quality, no discussion of mobile access, not even mentioned. People should, say, principle number two, be able to use any applications. Yes, but the protocols need to be open. There can't be proprietary APIs. You have to have a paradigm where it's possible for an entrepreneur or a big company to design to some known set of protocols, not discussed in these principles. People should be able to connect any physical hardware. Well, yes, but more important, all networks should be able to connect at almost no price. There's nothing about interconnection policy here, but everybody knew in the 90s that the internet was a network of networks. And competition, we should be in favor of competition, says the last of the principles. Would that be two firm competition or one firm competition? What are we talking about here? It makes all the difference in the world to have 5, 6, 7 competitors and ease of entry for anyone. Let one win if there's going to be a winner-take-all system, and let it always be that they won after something equivalent to March Madness. And there was always a new 64-team tournament right around the corner as the next innovation cycle hit. Those are real. That's what a real set of rules would look like. It would discuss these issues in a core manner. It's a valiant fight by very few people at the FCC, even to attach these vague principles as sort of conditions to mergers. But it is a sad day in our country when the Congress would pass a law that says you couldn't even have that discussion at the FCC or anywhere else, or anywhere else. What ought to be our paradigm? Much is to be said about it. I'll say a few things about it, and then if there's any questions or chat, we can have that. First of all, the government ought to create a public thoroughfare to the internet by regulation. Yes, just like in France, just like in Japan, just like in Korea. That public thoroughfare ought to be fast. I care less about how fast upstream and downstream it is on day one, and much more about the following, which is every year it ought to be faster. The technology permits it. That ought to be the rule. The public thoroughfare ought to be constantly improved, just like roads, just like the airline industry, just like all transportation systems in a country that has the national economic policy of improving everybody's standard of living and have it continually go up. That's point number one. If that means that a telephone company ought to get $1,000 per household in order to put fiber in the ground, and they want the money from the taxpayers, that is less than a tenth of the amount of money that's been budgeted over the next decade for the anti-missile defense system that doesn't work. You can't make these comparisons up. This is the truth. You can't make this up. You can't believe it. We have committed in Iraq more than $1 billion. And we're talking here about basing our information economy on expenditure, $1 trillion, sorry. And we're talking about basing our information economy on a subsidy which, according to the calculations I've done, to split the difference between willingness to pay an actual cost, not total cost, but the difference between willingness to pay an actual cost, it's maybe $20 billion, would be the necessary subsidy for fiber to the home for everyone. If you had that, it would be, technologically speaking, the work of but a moment to allocate some of it to a public thoroughfare. I would write the check, $20 billion, to the lowest cost provider that wanted to give me that fiber to the home in a heartbeat, let them have half of it for their VPN, the other half for the public thoroughfare. It's over. It's done. If it were one public thoroughfare, that's just fine. I really don't need more than one I-95. One is enough of a problem. But we ought to have a commitment to at least one. This astonishing regulatory idea isn't even voiced in Washington today. Point number two, this public thoroughfare ought to be for everyone, everyone, everywhere, all the time, in every way, meaning up and down, meaning through all patchworks of networks, for everyone, all the time, everywhere. It ought to be everyone in the country. It ought to be ubiquitous, which means it has to be wireless and wire. To say that in Washington today is to be left-wing, is to be thought to be crazy. It only happens to be the dominant paradigm in every developed and developing country in the world. This is the only country in the world where it can't even be said. Lastly, the most important thing about the public thoroughfare is that it gets us to a public space, and that space is the web. There are many things that Gigi and others are showing tremendous leadership about in terms of debating and articulating the fundamental precepts behind making sure that in that public space there is the right to be creative and that which ought to be public and generated out of a desire to be creative doesn't become subjected to a variety of proprietary claims. I honor all that. I only want to make one point. In this public space to which the public thoroughfare must take us, it is in that space that democracy in the United States will be defined. It is in that space that we will learn to debate issues and find out truth and form groups, and we won't agree with each other. And we will find in that space the way to debate with each other. It is in that space in China that will be determined the future of human rights versus totalitarianism. It is in that space, eventually, in the war-torn Middle East, that there will be that same debate between individual liberty and human rights and those that would deny it in the name of ideology. It is in that space on a global level all around the world that humanity will find expression. That space in the United States cannot be jeopardized by the lack of public thoroughfare, or at least it ought not be, without everybody in this room and all the people you're going to give my book to fighting for the right paradigm. Thank you very much.
Well, you should have seen this.
Where's Clegg? Hey, Clegg. No, Clegg. You're not Clegg. Where's Clegg?
I'm a Clegg.
Yeah, no, you, Clegg. Oh, you mean that someone else was using your name?
No, I'm just
there
are other
not on this planet.
Reed Hunt wasn't watching the screen, so why don't
he doesn't know that he's a raging socialist?
Tell him what you really think.
No, I'm just kidding. So I guess I would have a couple of questions. First of all, if you want the government to actually take this over,
Say take it over.
Well, you're suggesting an element, almost a sort of a socialist or a socialization of this public good.
No,
once it becomes a public good, and then the government has to protect
then
it and control it.
I didn't say it well enough. But give me one more crack.
Sure.
I'm happy to have the government write a check. Frankly, if Warren Buffett wanted to write it, that'd be fine with me, too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to have anyone write the check. The point I'm trying to make, maybe not so well, is how truly small the amount of money is relative to the value. How staggeringly small it is. When you look at what people are willing to pay, and you imagine that they would pay that, and then you see what's left over that still is part of the core cost of building an all-fiber network to the home, my estimate is it's about $20 billion. In an economy of $10 trillion, this is nothing. We're not having this debate in this country, not because the cost is so high. We're not having this debate because those who are shaping it see the possibility of profit maximization and find that there's no real rebuttal. A little, but no real rebuttal. And that's not evil. It only means one thing. It only means the reason why we created the open narrowband internet was to get enough advocates of an open web out there to deal with the reaction. And now's the time to deal with it.
Okay. Dave Hughes. Dave Hughes has never had a problem with Reed Hunt until this very minute, I'm sure. Isn't that true, Dave?
This is a throwback.
It was Dave who pushed me down the ice and broke my arm.
What's that?
It wasn't Dick Cheney.
Remember, I'm the one who brought Hedy Lamarr to the attention of the FCC way back. Now, The question is, and I'm going to put it in a more milder time than I did this morning when I never forgave for a series of decisions that you had. I will say, will you make the same decision again if you had it? It was a school library fund of $2.2 billion. I and many other library, I even got journalists in your face as best I could from Colorado, to change the rule or don't let the rule come in that made all of the connections to the schools, 85,000 of them, had to be a service, and the only service that could be done would be by the, essentially, at that time, were telcos, who laugh all the way to the bank. Now, the point was that what we lobbied for goes back to the early wireless, in which we contended that had money been able to be spent by the school to connect up their school buildings, not only would billions have been saved over time, but would begin the actual broadband locally inside of school districts. But the point was, not only did that rule prevent that, but today still, and your two successors didn't change it either, and I can't understand why, but for the 55 million students, that today you cannot, a school cannot, with school library funds, $2 billion, cross a right-of-way with fiber to another one of their own schools. And yet this is the future, the 3 million teachers knows. If you were to do it again, would you fight at least, because I know you were only one vote, but you were also only a partial of it. The thing that I never forgave the FCC, and I'm sorry, you were the head of it, so I have to say, yeah, was that that rule inhibited 15 years for the school kids being able, the schools having been able to be connected, and then to home until 100% of the next generation were connected broadband inside their little district and out to there. And so there may have been rules, but I could never get a lawyer at the FCC to tell me why it was legally not possible to do. Maybe it was, but nobody could ever answer it. Thank you.
I could never get lawyers at the FCC to tell me anything either. I never could get the lawyers to tell me what I wanted either, except for the ones that represented us in the Court of Appeals. You're talking about the E-rate. Let me make a couple of concessions quickly. There's never been a reasonably good government rule in my time of looking at them that was perfect. There are defects in anything. If we as a country were to write the $25 billion check to create the public thoroughfare to everyone, there'd be 4 million homes that got a degraded service out of 105 million. There'd be 72 megabits a second instead of 100 megabits a second. Everybody'd be, you know, whining about that. You know, my wife and I bought this Lexus hybrid the other day because we thought we would do the right thing, you know, for having her drive around in style and at the same time save the environment. And it gets 19 miles a gallon instead of 31. I mean, like, life is filled with disappointments. But here's the big story, in my judgment, with respect. The big story is that as a country, with a unanimous Republican and Democratic vote in the FCC, we were able to create $4 billion, $2 billion out of the FCC, $2 billion by the school districts, spent every year on internet access in classrooms. And that is why today, 85% of all the kids age 6 to 20, 85% have used and learned about the internet at school. Now, that is almost half again the penetration in that group outside of school. It's in school that they learned about the internet, that they found out the skills, and they've become the constituency of the information society of the future. Now, a lot of things had to be accepted to get that vote. Schools can't buy computers with that money. You know, they, as you said, they can't go out and contract for fiber networks that run across a variety of lines. There's a lot of ways. You know, I used to tell them, just let me run the whole thing, and you know, it will turn out better, except for the next wave auction. But you know, it's a commission. With respect to network neutrality, same big point. If we got it largely right, that would be fine. There would be lots of things to complain about. We have it right now overwhelmingly not right. And that's what I would say about the E-rate. It's largely right, in my view.
Okay. Shant?
Say it. Chairman Hunt, Sean Hovnanian, LMDS Negotiated Rulemaking Committee. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, yeah, LMDS, yeah.
You remember.
Part of ISDN, investment still doing nothing.
Well, it has a lot to do with the rulemaking process.
It does.
And I wanted to ask you, through that grueling experience that we all had, what can we build into pending legislation to expedite those rulemakings that foster technology rather than hamper it? Second thing is, suppose we flip the model upside down and don't look at wireless as an asset to sell.
Right.
But look at it as an asset to license the end user.
Right.
And let it be open source. Open source wireless spectrum. Put it out there and let people build on top of it.
Right. Well, LMDS and many other satellite stories are stories of, you know, lobbying, trumping business plans, and process defeating any kind of business vision. And they are disappointing stories. And I'm sympathetic in the extreme with the people who suffered those disappointments. And since I left the FCC, I've been disappointed in my own life in many of these issues. They're all part of one large story or one large point in my view, and that's this. The wireless spectrum, in fact, has the potential to contribute more to very low cost, high productivity access to the public space than any other single topic that we can address. Michael here, sitting right in front of you, has told us all publicly many ways in which this is true, you know, in his speeches and his work. So have others here. At this time, once again, we have it largely wrong, not largely right in our country. We are slowly meeting out spectrum, putting it into private hands in ways that maximize the price per pop, maximize the price of access, minimize the penetration, reduce entrepreneurship. It's largely wrong. It may happen anyhow that enough spectrum leaks out over the next several years to create a very, very different environment. But it hasn't happened yet. You actually have legislation in Congressman Barton's bill about municipal Wi-Fi. You know, frankly, if he'd had his way, you know, he would have written it so as to make sure that there would be less use of unlicensed spectrum. There should be unlimited use, and there should be a lot more of it. These are very important issues. When LMDS was done, hardly anyone was even talking about them, except the protagonists. The one thing we can take some comfort in is now, today, wireless is understood to be a national asset that is ever renewing, unlike any other asset we know. And if we can just press forward on that basis, we have some chance of really making sure that it will contribute to a high and rising standard of living. Yes, sir.
Gary Arlen.
Hi, Gary.
Communications. Two things. One, I just want to do a reality check, as my copy editor insists. Did you say $25 billion? Did it go up 20% between the beginning and end of your speech?
20 to 25 billion.
Oh, okay, we still.
That's the difference between, in my calculations, between the amount people would pay for extraordinarily high-speed broadband and the amount that it would cost. Right.
Yep.
And why does that exist? Because there are places where it's very costly to deploy it, and there are user groups that don't have very much money to pay.
I've got a more substantive question, though, for you. OneNote Frankston down here keeps putting up things, and others keep putting up things about separating bits and content. We've heard the argument for years, content, conduit, transmission, whatever you want to call it. But even in your day, and especially now again, we're hearing more about convergence in that unreal world that the marketplace is creating. To Gigi's point before about regulating mass media and telecom under some kind of a unified system. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because I think one of the issues that underlies a lot of what we talk about here has been focused on telephone companies, as the thread talks about. And the world is really of being governed by, being influenced by non-regulated or differently regulated media companies, which are part of this equation, according to some. Can we get your thoughts on that, and where do you think that'll go?
I think that in general, over the last 5 years, and admitting that this is a little unfair, in pursuit of regulatory harmony, our government writ large has picked the worst of the paradigms and imposed it harmoniously on everyone. I don't think there's a big difference. There are differences, but not a huge difference between the way any particular network builder or any content company is treated and any other. They're all part of this move to an almost completely privatized system. Now, if it were up to me, I'd say let's have an auction. Whoever comes forward on a local basis, one local region after another, and says, I will be the lowest cost provider of the 100 megabit a second public thoroughfare, take the lowest cost provider of that physical medium and give them the money that they ask in that auction. And then after that existed, if you had the truly high speed, that robust a network, the business paradigm changes completely. When you've built a all-fiber network, you're looking for traffic. You're not talking about how you want to use price to constrain traffic. And that's the difference between where we are now and where we could be.
Time for one more question, brief.
Please, and a brief answer, please. I'm Matt Larson from VistaBeam. I'm a wireless service provider in some very rural areas in the Midwest, and also representative of the Wireless Internet Service Provider Association. One of your comments, you made it pretty clear that you're for telecom subsidies. And I'm kind of against that because from our experience, we've seen that the subsidy process is very prone to gaming by large corporations. It's tied up a lot of usable spectrum that could be used for broadband, but instead sitting idle in MMDS, ITFS, places where the incumbents aren't doing anything. And smaller operators can't play that game. It's a disincentive for innovation. What's the right answer to that?
There are good public purposes served by some expenditures of money, and there are special interest pork claims served by other expenditures of money. I think that when you look at a Congress that has expanded pork to a level that would make any pig farmer blush, you have to begin to wonder if it is conceivable to have any legitimate public spending. That would be a reasonable reaction to the last several Congresses. However, I believe that there is such a thing as public property, and I don't believe that the Constitution permits the government to seize private property and turn it into public property. So insofar as I'm for some subsidies, all I mean to be saying is there are very minuscule, very modest public expenditures that can be appropriate to create very substantial public property. That's all I mean to say. That has nothing to do with the misallocation and mislicensing of satellite spectrum, for example, which is, you know, a policy tragedy unto itself, but I don't think it's related to this point. The fact that universal service today exists primarily to subsidize voice instead of to subsidize broadband and let VOIP provide voice for free, that's just a question of people saying, you know, instead of doing the wrong thing, we ought to do the right thing. To me, it doesn't mean that you just give up debating for the right thing.
Chairman Hunt,
thank you
so much for coming.
Thank you. Here.